Today, the rest of faith and why ours sometimes goes wrong.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So, we had a fairly meandering journey around faith and some of its opposites and how those can help us understand what it looks like during the last episode, all to get to what I want to talk about today, which is when we recognize pride as an opposite of faith. And there are a lot of different opposites that we talked about. I'll bring them back up here in just a moment. It can help us understand when our faith has gone awry. And so what I want to do right now is just give a little synopsis, not of the last entire episode, but of the concept that I have in mind when I'm saying we run into some problems where we think we're defending our faith, and in reality, all we're doing is demonstrating that we don't have any. And so what I mean by that starts with this idea about faith that has to do with the other aspects of faith, not the humility that goes as an opposite to pride, like I'm talking about with faith throughout the conversation today, but the other aspects of faith, which we identified by their opposites. And each of those, and this is the problem, this is the whole problem today, that all those other aspects of faith, I'll name them in just a minute, all of those can become a little, you know, hand-cranked jack. I'm thinking of the cars, you know, when you lift it up something. Each of those aspects of faith can itself become this little hand-cranked jack that starts to lift us up toward pride because of what our faith is giving us, even when we think what we're doing is faithful. So as an example, where we take the opposite of faith to be inconsistency, because faith is also faithfulness. You know, he's a faithful person. He's consistent. He has integrity. What we're doing is identifying faithfulness as integrity, which can become something that is a mark of pride for us. Ooh, I have this and they don't, kind of thing. Not because it's wrong to have integrity, but because once we have something that we can identify in others as lacking, then we can, you know, start to jack that thing up. You know, oh, look at me. I'm above them. I've got integrity. So you see how this works. The same thing with what I started out with as infidelity, meaning you just don't believe. So having doubt, that identifies faith as belief. And belief is a step toward confidence. You know, the more you believe, the stronger your belief, the greater your confidence that what you're thinking is true. And you can hear, it's a hop, skip, and a jump from there to just straight up pride. The same thing using disobedience as the opposite of faith, because remember the trust and obey, and trust as an apposition to obedience, that's faithfulness being perseverance. That, you know, when we disobey is when things have gotten tough and we think, oh, well, I'll do it my own way. I'm not going to continue to obey. This nonsense is bringing harm to me. And so faithfulness becomes perseverance. Ooh, well, I endured it. You know, I walked uphill both ways to school through the snow. Why couldn't you do it? And it becomes a mark of pride, even though it really was an act of faith in the time. And the same thing with hypocrisy, because then faith becomes sincerity, and then it becomes a test of whether others measure up to the depth of sincerity that you have when you're seeing them. It's almost impossible that it wouldn't become that just because of our human nature. So what I want to do is take that kind of thinking about faith and how faith can become a trap for us, and apply it to some things I've actually seen happen. But instead of just jumping into the things I see happen, I want to use a couple of examples from Scripture to say this is the point of what's going on in Jesus' ministry. Throughout his ministry, God himself gives the faith to his people on stone tablets on Mount Sinai. He hands them to them, and it still turns into an act of pride on the part of his people to keep people out. And Jesus confronts them about that over and over again, saying, your faith has become the barrier to you having faith. All of those indications of faith, you've lost them all because of your zealous pursuit of the faith that I actually gave you. That's what I see happen to us, and I'm including myself in this category. It happens to me as more often than anybody else, if I were to base it on my experience. It's not hard to figure out why that would be, but it's the reality. It happens to me all the time, and so I just kind of want to clarify where this is. So, you know, where is it that I'm talking about pride creeping in to replace faith? And often it happens when we feel like, so this is what we're experiencing when we should recognize, oh, maybe my pride's taken over here. It's when we feel like knowledge or information or opinions or experiences or perspectives, things, and I'm talking about them negatively now, even though they're good things, when in our sense they become somehow negative. Oh, that's bad knowledge. That's bad information. That opinion stinks. Those experiences aren't valid. That perspective doesn't even deserve to be heard. It ought to be kept out of the environment. Our kids don't need to read that material. When knowledge or information or opinions or experiences or perspectives become an enemy to faith, I think very often it's because our faith has really converted itself into its opposite. It has become a point of pride. So, you know, why is it that that would happen? Why are we doing that? What are we thinking? And what happens is that a claim, let's take knowledge or information or opinions or whatever, some claim is made and it contradicts what we believe. Then we have to say to ourselves, that claim, whatever's producing that claim, that must be the enemy of my faith because I believe this and that claim challenges it. So I just want to take a couple of specific examples of what happens with Jesus when he threatens the faith of the people that he's around and there to redeem and what they do to respond. So Luke 4, great example, early in Jesus' ministry, comes to Nazareth, back, you know, his hometown, where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, I'm reading to you from Luke 4:16, you'll recognize, famous passage, as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, stood up to read, you know this part, he reads from Isaiah 61, he gets down to the conclusion of the passage, you know, he's setting at liberty those who are oppressed to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, and then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. I'm in verse 20 of Luke 4. The eyes of all the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, today the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. And so they hear it, and they're like, hey, this is Joseph's son. Why are they? And Jesus' response to their doubts about him is to say, look, he says to them, doubtless you'll quote me this proverb at some point, physician, heal yourself, when he's on the cross, for instance. What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do here in your hometown as well. And he said, so in other words, he's saying to them, I know what you're saying. You're saying, oh, well, if you're so significant, if this is the coming of the Lord, show us a sign. Do it here. Show us right here in your hometown that this is happening. And he says, look, this is, by the way, where that a prophet's not despised except in his own country kind of idea comes from. That's what he's about to say. He gives them the story of Elijah and the widow of Zarephath. But he gives it to them, making the point obvious so they can't even get around it. So he said, look, truly, I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his own hometown. That's not just because he's, you know, familiar to everybody. This is how we use it colloquially. I'm not trying to explain the whole passage, but I do want you to get the main point of the passage. It doesn't have to do with the fact, well, your people know you, so they're just not impressed with you. That's not it. In his hometown, he should be their advocate. That's what they want. ooh, we got a prophet. Look, we've got a great hero. We've got somebody who went on to win an Olympic gold medal. That man's going to represent our city. So he should be their advocate. But Jesus says, this is not going to work because that's not what I'm here for. In truth, I tell you, Jesus says, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah. That's his hometown, Israel. That's where he's from. There were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months and a great famine came over all the land, and Elijah was sent to none of them, not one in his hometown, not one in Israel. I'm using it metaphorically. Not one. He wasn't sent to any of those widows, but instead to a Gentile widow, a widow in the land of the enemy God, a widow in the land of Zarephath, in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow, and there were many lepers. Goes on to an example from the next prophet, Elisha. There were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only a Gentile, Naaman, the Syrian. So what he's doing is confronting them with something that contradicts where their faith has taken them. Their faith has said to them, God called us. God claims to own us. God has given us the doctrines, the covenants. He's given us the ark. He's given us the temple. He's given us the prophets. We are his people. Their faith has become pride. That's it. I mean, that's what it became. And so Jesus confronts them with what their faith is actually supposed to be saying to them. What's it all about? You know, love the Lord your God, your neighbor as yourself. And then in explaining what that means, that's everybody. That's everybody. So when Jesus says to them, look, I'm here to reach out to the people you despise because you think they're inferior to you, and they're not, he challenges their faith. And when their faith, which has become pride, when their faith is challenged, the response they have to him, well, this is what it says in verse 28. When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath. They don't say to themselves, well, I disagree with that. Let's see if we can get some propositions together and create a debate team and give a response to this man. There's no rational response. There's anger because they're being threatened. They're going to be toppled from this pinnacle they think they have arrived at. So when they heard these things, they're filled with wrath, and they rose up and they drove him out of the town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built so they could throw him down the cliff. Of course, he, passing through their midst, went his way. He's doing his job. He's confronting what they think is a legitimate expression of their faith, but has become the opposite of that, has become indeed a mark of their own pride. In the same way, when Jesus threatens the Jewish leaders later in Matthew 21, when it comes out, this is during the triumphal entry and just afterwards, he enters into the temple and the chief priests, the elders of the people, come to him as he's teaching, and they say, now he's been doing all kinds of things all around Israel, now he's in Jerusalem doing it, and so they want to question him because they think they have the authority, and he doesn't have a right to undermine where they are. That's just pride. That's all there is to it. And so anyway, they come to him and they say, by what authority? Who put you on the pedestal? We're the ones on the pedestal. Prove that you should be up here with us. By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? And Jesus answers and says, I'll ask you one question. And if you tell me the answer, I'll also tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, where'd that come from? From heaven or from man? What do you think? And they discussed it among themselves, and the only reason they can't answer him is because they don't care about learning something and increasing their faith. They don't care about their doctrine being correct. They care about maintaining their power, and they're afraid of every answer they give undermining their own authority. That's why he put them on the horns of that dilemma. So he says, do you think it came from heaven or from man? And they discussed it among themselves, and they said, well, we're in a dilemma here. We got a problem because we're going to lose our position. Not, we might grow our faith here. We might actually learn something that gets us closer to God. Not that. But if we say from heaven, well, then he'll say, you should have believed John the Baptist because he said, I was the reason you're supposed to believe. So what's wrong with you guys? But if we say from man, Well, we're afraid of the crowd because they all hold that John was a prophet. They're afraid of a crowd they know is more powerful than they are, and they want to maintain this show of authority they have over the crowd. I cannot imagine a better model or example of what pride is than that. So the answer they gave to Jesus, we don't know. And so he said to them, then I'm not going to tell you anything either. I mean, that was the deal. You tell me, I'll tell you. Their problem is that they're trying to preserve their faith with the very opposite of what that faith is supposed to be. In both cases of those stories that I was just giving you, the faith, the doctrine that we hold, has built us up, put us in the, I'm using us, meaning let's put ourselves in the position of these religious leaders, because this is who we become. We've become the normal religion, right? We're the standard for our culture. So in both cases, the faith or the doctrine that we hold has built us up into a secure place, and then the confrontation is shaking that secure place. So notice this, it doesn't shake the doctrine. It doesn't shake the reality of what God has given us. It just shakes the thing we used that faith for. Oh, well, it made me feel good about myself. It made me feel better about my position. It gave me a sense of security. My sense of security is going away. That must be my faith going away. No, it's not. That's not the same thing. What we get from our faith is not the same thing that our faith is. So what we end up doing, because we don't recognize that, we confuse the things, we use our faith, our belief in this doctrine or our practice or our integrity or whatever it is, as a reason to block what real faith ought to be able to do for us. Look, this is that what real faith does is what it did for Abraham. He's the father of faith. This is why we talk about him this way. For Abraham, he believes God will raise Isaac from the dead. He could very easily have had the same response that the Jewish leaders had. He could very easily have said, "You're not going to tell me to kill my son Isaac." A perfectly reasonable response, isn't it? His whole future, his confidence in God is the reason God gave him a son. He had faith. God gave him a son. The son is the consequence of his faith. The son is not his faith. So when Abraham, the father of faith, is confronted with something that might take away the very thing his faith brought that he desired so greatly, the great evidence of his friendship with God is that he says, "I'll give up anything to keep trusting you. I will give up anything because I know that you can do anything." And so he has a belief, according to the author of Hebrews, that God could even raise Isaac from the dead if he wanted to. "I'll do anything." Our faith isn't supposed to be secured in our ability to protect it. That's not what our faith is. I don't need to protect my faith. It ought to be, faith itself ought to be our shelter when there's no other protection. When everything else we hold dear is crucified, that we would still say, but I believe God. That's what our faith is supposed to take us to. That's why Job's line, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him," is so important. That's why the line in my favorite psalm, Psalm 116, after all these psalms, 86 in, it's still 116. I still go home there, is "I believed even when the only thing I could say was, I'm greatly afflicted." I mean, it's almost like a line from the book of Job. This is the point of our faith. That's our shelter. Our faith is our shelter, not our ability to defend it, not this rock-solid pinnacle on which we have now arrived because our faith was so great. I have all the things the rest of the world doesn't have. Not that. Our shelter is our faith, not the things we do to defend it. A warning sign, and this is really what I want us to notice, and, I'm preaching to myself in both of these episodes. A warning sign that we've replaced faith with the benefit it gave us, which becomes pride. Whatever that benefit is, it turns into pride. We view ourselves as being in a better place. A warning sign that we have replaced our faith with whatever that is when we're saying things like, and I've heard this so many times, this is the greatest threat to the Christian faith since. And I don't even know what you put in that sentence to make sense of it. But since, I don't know, sliced bread, you know, since the martyrs of the early church, you know, yeah, that almost destroyed the church, didn't it? It almost completely destroyed faith, didn't it? Of course not. There's no risk to faith. I should restate that. Risk is not a threat to faith. That's not an issue because our faith is real. It's in a God who's real, a God who's actually doing things. So it doesn't make sense for us to look at the things that threaten where our faith has put us as if they're some terrible threat. They are a threat to us. They are a threat to the place we've arrived. They are a threat to the things we wanted to achieve. But they're no threat to God, and therefore they're no threat to the reality of what our faith is supposed to be, which is simply a place to exercise our confidence in God. The only question about faith, it's not ever whether it's going to survive or not. The question about faith is whether we're going to have it. So, you know, faith can be a problem or, you know, face a problem wherever, for instance, knowing, so, you know, knowledge replaces or has to replace belief, believing. And I don't mean by that we can't know things. Of course we can know things. Believing and trusting are perfectly compatible with knowing things. In fact, when you know something, you most definitely believe it and have faith in it. You can't help it because you know it. The problem is when believing or trusting are not enough. If we can't also prove something or assert it without any, well, I mean, the thing we're talking about, humility, the opposite of pride. If I've known people like this. I've heard people give testimonies like this. Well, I was going down the road and trying to figure out whether I should have faith or not. And then I read this book and, oh, I saw all these proofs that God does exist and so on. And so I believed, and I've been on this journey to try to prove all of these things. And those are the people who end up without any faith whatsoever. That's not our calling. That's not what we do. And I'm not even saying those things are not valuable. I do philosophy. I care about arguments for the existence of God. I think they're valuable for a variety of reasons. But that's not how you arrive at faith. And by the way, the problem with that, with, you know, having to have knowledge instead of just belief, because belief's not good enough, means that what we have done is replace trust with self-assurance. Well, I know it now. Now I don't have to wonder about it. There is a movement. I mean, I was a part of it for a long time, and I value a lot of things that come out of this movement, the fundamentalist Christian movement in general. But as a response to science and evolution, trying to use the scientific method but with religious data to come to the same conclusions that science does, but with proof that all the things the Bible says are absolutely the case, that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. I mean, none of that is necessarily untrue. Sure, that's fine. You go and you find things and you research things and you discover, hey, lo and behold, there is a Cyrus that the Bible talks about, and he did live at the same time that there was a Nehemiah and blah, blah, blah. And I'm using different names at different times, just making the point. Yeah, those are historical figures. Great. And you can do research and find out that there was an Abraham at this time and that there was a whatever. And that's great. I'm happy with all of that. I don't have any problem with all of that at all. The problem is when we make that the contingency of our faith, that we act as if that's the reason that we would have faith. That's pride. That is an effort to show others that we're as good as they are or better than they are. You know, the same thing happens when behavior instead of knowledge is the thing we replace belief with. And again, I don't mean by that believing isn't going to change our behavior. Of course it's going to change our behavior. Belief is perfectly compatible with action. It makes perfect sense. In fact, we should be critical of any Christian movement that's advocating for social improvement without a connection to Jesus being Lord. I mean, those things are attached, action to belief, belief to action. I'm totally happy with that. The thing that happens that we have to be critical of is when we're advocating for social improvement without that connection to Jesus being Lord. So it's legitimate to be able to say, there are problems that came from the progressive liberal or existential Christian movement as a response. You know, it was responding honestly to arid dogmatism. I've got all the propositions. I've got the list. I agree with them. Therefore, I have faith. I don't do anything about it. But yeah, there was something missing there. But creating a movement that said, "Oh, I'm just going to behave," so you can hear how the problems would come from that. The distinction between those two things, works and faith, for instance, and then the way we put them together is, you know, what explains a lot of the confusion about the social justice movement right now. Because it is equally right to be critical of a Christian movement that advocates, and this is what I do, I'm critical of a Christian movement that would advocate for the acknowledgement that Jesus is Lord and not have any concern for the social benefit of the people who are around us. Jesus doesn't give room for that in the gospel. But you can hear how all of that can become a sign of pride when we say, "Oh, well, I take care of the poor, you know. Let me do a selfie here while I'm feeding this poor man. Here, poor man, stand here and show, so people can see I put food in the mouth of the poor. Do you see how godly I am now?" I mean, it's just, you know, putting on airs of our faith, and that's pride, not faith. So, I mean, that's another form it can take. So the problem, you know, is when our efforts, and I do mean them alone, it's not like God makes us passive instruments. We are involved when things happen. But it's a problem when our efforts alone replace the confidence that God's the one who can affect change. It happens with our evangelism. You know, why do you go and share the good news with somebody? Because you have faith. I believe that. It's because you were changed by the good news, and you want other people to know the good news. No qualms about that. There's no harm in that whatsoever. I'm all for that. But when evangelism becomes a need to control the outcome, no, you've got to, and this is my gentle way of saying, I remember when I got angry, but I'm going to put it on my friend. I had a friend one time, he got mad because people would not pray in repentance and accept the conversion God wanted to give them. Why? Because my faith had become pride. What, I'm presenting the gospel correctly, I'm giving you all the right information, I'm persuasive, am I not persuasive? And then, why wouldn't you accept the faith? What's wrong with you? Why on earth would you think that my faith is inadequate for you? And so on. Or, well, the constant argument we gave, and you can go back and listen to the Death of a Salesman episodes to also hear this part, but it's our argument that, well, if they don't believe now, they could walk away, get hit by a truck, and then they never believe, so I need to do it. It's all or nothing right now. We don't care that we're driving them away from the gospel with the way we're talking to them and making them nothing more than merchandise. You know, I need to string you onto my belt as a victim of the gospel, you know. That we don't realize we're treating people that way, and we're demonstrating to them that we don't really trust God to bring them to salvation. I mean, we share good news. We proclaim good news. We tell good news. But God brings conversion. God brings the fruit. That's where faith puts us. Pride puts us in the position where we're trying to control the outcome. That's what I'm talking about. So all the other aspects of faith, the ones that I was talking about at the very beginning of this episode, the ones that we identified by their opposites, they each are the things that can easily become a tool for us to become proud. So where faith is integrity, or faith is confidence, or faith is perseverance, or faith is sincerity, those things can become a problem for us. And the indicator that those things have become a problem for us, that in other words, the practical signs that pride has taken over for where our faith should still be, are, I think, and I think it just comes down to really two things that give evidence of this: fear and anger. When we are afraid, it's like those Jewish leaders who were afraid because they knew the people favored Jesus and they wanted to hang on to their power, and so how are we going to do something? you know, fear is an indication that we believe we're losing control. Anger. I mean, this is the statements in James. I get to go back to James. The wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. And why do we have either one? Why do we have fear or anger? Because we feel like we're losing control. Well, you know, the need for control is not exactly a hail testimony to your faith. That's the opposite of having faith. I need to control this situation. Okay, well, fine, but don't say your faith is telling you you have to control this situation. Your faith says God is in control, and your job is to follow where God is leading. So the sign on the opposite side, the sign that that faith might actually be real, that it might actually be getting somewhere, is in the fact that you don't have to have control of things. This is really hard for me. I don't even like other people to drive. I like to be in control, you know. I don't like that I like to be in control. I just do. When I've told you about my extreme anxiety with the dentist. Completely my fault. Dentists are all, apparently, angels sent from heaven who do nothing but good in the world. And I would never imply otherwise. I believe that. Fine. But the point is, I have some serious anxiety when I go to the dentist. I've told you. I've started going to a sedation dentist for big work, you know, whenever things have to be done. I mean, I go there for cleanings too, but they don't put me to sleep for the cleanings. I kind of wish they would, but they don't. And that would be a little excessive. I can live through that. That's fine. But I've told you, in going to the dentist, when I'm going to have a root canal, and I have that. I had one of those recently. When I'm going to have, you know, some kind of serious work done on my teeth, they put me to sleep. Well, when he was telling me about how they do this, and I'm like, hallelujah, you know, they're going to put this stuff. I don't even care. I'll deal with a needle in my arm. I don't like needles either, so I got all kinds of problems. We'll talk about more about those later. Don't let your pride say, oh, I don't have a problem with needles. He must be weak. Or maybe it's my pride saying, don't you put yourself above me just because you, whatever. The point is, I would even put up with a needle. I'm thinking, you know, I'm in a hospital bed. I've got all the stuff. I'm completely unconscious. And when he says to me, the dentist says, okay, so what we're going to give you is an amnesiac. And I'm like, wait a minute, what? I thought I was going to be asleep. Well, I have to be able to give you commands, and you have to follow the commands while I'm working in your mouth, you know, so it's part of the deal. But it's the same as going to sleep for you. You'll wake up, you won't know a thing. I'm like, this sounds terrifying. This sounds like I'll be fully awake experiencing all of the pain, and you'll be okay with it because I'm not going to remember later that I want to sue your pants off, which I wouldn't do because I'm not litigious. That's what it feels like to me. And he's like, no. We'll do all the. It won't be a problem for you. I promise it'll be okay. He's like, so I have two choices. I have this stuff. It's a little bit stronger. This stuff. You know what I'm saying. Give me the strongest possible stuff you have. And he says, look, it'll work. It'll be fine. They're all fine. Have you ever had laughing gas? He asks me. Because he's going to say, look, you know how that helped you. This is way stronger than that. I'm like, yeah, I had laughing gas, and it did nothing. Absolutely nothing. I can't turn off. So when people give me stuff that's supposed to make me stop feeling stuff or make me stop caring about stuff, I'm still sitting there debating them. I'm still in an... And you know what he said to me? He said, oh, so anesthesia doesn't work well on you. Well, you know what that means? It means you have the kind of mind that really likes to be in control. It's like, oh, yeah, great. Thank you for the evaluation, Mr. Counselor. But he's right. I mean, he's absolutely right. That's the thing. And so this is a real struggle for me. And I've dealt with my whole life. And now I'm dumping on you because I've dealt with it my whole life. But I suspect I'm not alone. I just suspect I'm not. It may not be at the same level it is for me, but I do know it's there. And so the fact that my faith ultimately is signified, not that it's the same thing, but that it's signified by the fact that I don't have to be in control in a situation, is something that's been hard for me to learn. You know, when I'm offended by people who are being unjust, and it's part of my nature, in all the psychological examination tests that you do to say, what kind of person are you? the variety of ones that I've done, it's always a super high priority for me that things be just, you know, that things be made right. It's not necessarily the highest priority, but it's one of the priorities for me. And so I'm, you know, I am, when somebody slights me or says something insulting to me or something like that, it's, you know, if they're completely without power, I can just shrug it off. It's not a big deal. But people who are able to hurt me and do that, it's crushing. You know, it's very difficult. I have to work really hard to get past that. And now, I mean, over time, I've come to realize, and I actually talked to a person who taught counseling for us at Criswell College for a long time and said, "Why, you know, what do you think's going on here? I mean, what do you think I should do?" And he pointed out, "Oh, so you are just so insulted in that moment. You feel like they're putting you down and there's no way for you to get out of that pit." And it's, you know, he wasn't even finished with the sentence. And it's like, oh, it's just pride. It's just my pride. Wow. Okay. Well, I should probably burn that. And it's not hard to realize you should get rid of it when you realize that it's just pride. That's the point for me. And that's what I've been trying to communicate in both of these episodes, that our faith, it's very easy for it to become really nothing but pride, a thing we value because of the way it has given us a better footing in the world, that it's given us a stronger position in relation to others. And a lot of the ways people give even their own testimony really is nothing more than saying, and now people can think good things about me instead of bad things about me. And it is true. When your life changes, people do think better things about you. That's true. There's no harm in that. But that outcome is not the same thing as your faith. And it's not the same thing as losing your faith if you lose that outcome. Why have the faith if I don't even have a job and I lost this and that about the stability of my life? Because God's goal in your life isn't giving you control over everything. It isn't raising you up and making you more prominent than everyone else. And I'm preaching to myself. His goal in your life is your trust in him. That's what he's working. So let me run towards the end this way. The component of faith that has to be incorporated from the outset in all the other elements of faith, where we're talking about it as integrity or confidence or perseverance or sincerity, all of those different manifestations of faith that can become proud, the component of faith that has to be incorporated from the outset into all of those others is humility. I mean, just think, it's not complicated. Without humility, integrity becomes this, oh, I hate saying this because it's just so true about the first half of my entire Christian life. It becomes judgmental arrogance. And again, it's not just me. Look at all of Scripture. This is what Israel becomes as a nation. They become the people who point their fingers at others and in the minor prophets are constantly condemned because of their, literally, these words, holier than thou disposition toward the nations around them. We are holier than you. Confidence without humility. Confidence, the thing that faith builds in us because we believe and it's affirmed and reassured over and over again, and we gain in confidence. That confidence without humility becomes self-assurance.
Well, I'm always right. You know, I don't have to doubt anything.
Without humility, perseverance becomes self-congratulatory. Look at all that I have endured to arrive at this place. Without humility, sincerity becomes a proxy for intensity, fervor, self-sufficiency. I can bring this to pass. But with humility, all of those things, integrity, confidence, perseverance, the sincerity of our convictions, they become reasons to be grateful. Integrity teaches us to respond to things like criticism without having to be afraid. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking somehow I cheated, somehow I whatever. I'm saying in response to criticism. I know, but all I can tell you is this is the thing that my faith led me to do. And you're not afraid. Oh, no, my reputation. Jesus sits with a woman at a well knowing that everyone's going to say, what's he doing talking to her? And he He doesn't care about his reputation. He cares about the faith. Respond, you know, it allows us, so when we have humility, it allows us to respond to criticism, face crises, endure suffering, face unanswerable questions without fear and without anger. It's almost as if we can replace all of that fear and all of that anger with, how about 2 Timothy's language, power and love and self-control. Not ours, not my power, not my love, not my self-control, because it's only the case that we can replace fear and anger with those things if the power and love and self-control are credits not to us, but to something bigger than us that's working in us. That's when being sick isn't a sign that you lack faith. And I remember being in college and having a whole movement of religion down in the Waco area that was about that. If you're sick, you must lack faith. That must be the case. When we're in a position where we realize that all the credit's going to go to God no matter what, that's when being sick isn't a sign that you lack faith, but an opportunity to live it. That's when you have humility in these things, when you're recognizing they are a gift from God, that's when a trial to abandon our faith becomes a reason to cling to it. Had that conversation with someone just recently, and we've talked about it on here with the deconstruction of Christianity that a lot of people are going through, that the reason so many people who were raised in Christianity now look at it and say, that's nothing but hypocrisy, I need to tear it apart and take it out of my life, and then don't rebuild it, is because they forget that the things they know that make Christianity hypocritical in its practice are the things they know about what Christianity really is and ought to be. So our trial that brings about the question of whether we should abandon our faith, when we have some humility about our own acknowledgement that the problem's in us, not in it, becomes a reason to cling to that faith. The same thing happens if we have humility in our faith. That's when questions, doubts, worries, when questions become a reason to have an honest and maybe even painful conversation with God. That's what most of the Psalms are. God, why is this why aren't you acting? Why don't you wake up and do something? How do you have that with God at a time when you're doubting him, unless your faith is about him and not you, your pride, you being knocked off the pedestal? Then, when our humility is governing what we do, that's when those questions become a reason for having that honest conversation with God. And that's what our faith should take us to. So, in other words, have a little faith. And with all your faith, don't forget humility.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.